All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter, for the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Steve, for and Mike and you guys for setting aside part of your Saturday to work on this. This is a great opportunity.
Hope it'll be fun.
Okay. So if we start out on the homepage that I posted in the HC01 chat room, you guys have that page up?
I do not. See.
Okay, it should be backowl.sourceforge.net.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yep. There we go.
Okay.
Okay. So the other site, if you actually want to see what is in the repository of the raw files, what I did is, you know, I've been writing scripts to be able to take the mangled up version of ASN1 and try to rewrite it in OWL. So if you want to have access to the code, I will, let's see, browse code repository here. Okay, so if you look at that link, then you'll actually see the stuff right out of SourceForge. So what I did for today's session is I took the TTL files that I just recently generated, and then I sort of added a bunch of commentary and questions so that we can sort of go through the design, and I can describe what the design decisions that I made and how they relate to the BACnet standard using BACnet terminology, and we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So if you want to see the actual, you know, the full Magilla, you know, TTL files and OWL files and RDF files, then you can go directly to the code repository. And, of course, you can, you know, clone the Git repository to your own directory if you want to run these. I don't expect you guys to do that. Not during the hackathon. This is going to be more of a conversation than anything. But I just want to give you pointers about where this stuff was.
Joel, I let me just throw a topic right in right away. I was talking to Marty Burns. Do you know Marty Burns?
Absolutely.
And he was telling me how the BACnet standard is a pretty rich ontology with a lot of cross associations and objects and things, and I didn't see that at all in the files that you generated so far.
Right. Well, the ones that I have right now, if you look at the homepage, are the primitive data types and constructed data types, and I actually haven't populated all of the objects yet.
Ah.
Okay. So the problem with doing script population of these objects is I want to make sure that I have the object framework done first, because the way I view this stuff as a C++ and Python programmer is I have a tendency to do a lot of metaclass programming, so my head is in sort of the template class, metaclass world, and I don't quite understand how that translates into OWL. So as you see on the first couple of parts of this, once we go through the primitive and constructed data types, then the real guts of the hard part of this will be objects and properties. So after that is done, then I can run a template that matches against all of the objects and properties that are currently in the standard, and it'll be a much larger presentation. It won't be any more complicated than it is now. It'll just be more of the same.
Well, there seem to be no associations going on. I mean, there seem to be a huge number of enumerations.
Right.
But not any relationships between objects.
Right. So Well, one of the things about the BACnet model is that it is essentially just a collection of objects and properties. It's not really a way of binding objects together into applications. That's up to the vendor for their particular implementation. So if you think about this as a set of data structures with implicit data types and functions and services that transfer information in and out of those data structures, then that's pretty much it.
Mm.
Now, there are there are special purpose messages for objects that are transitioning in state. For example, from going from a normal condition to an alarm condition. But a lot of those things are very closely associated with properties that are changing value. So there are event notifications for properties that change value, and there are commands for objects that are changing state from, you know, in alarm to not in alarm, and there's a couple of different types of alarm conditions and that kind of thing. But for the most part, it's actually pretty simple. I mean, it's big just because it has a fairly rich data model, but it's not actually structurally that complicated.
And by rich, you mean, in other words, lots of different kinds of data types, but not really many connections between them. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Now, the other problem is, as we get into this a little bit later, is that the relationship between the components of these, I don't know how to express.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll
okay. And so I should have those described as we get into these pieces. All right, so let's pick up on the vendor page, and I will paste that link in the chat room so that other people know where we are.
So maybe a
Oops.
Question.
Yeah.
This is Mike. My impression, kind of looking at, you know, both some of the work you've done and reading about back then, is most of the things are really message formats we're sending over the wire.
Yes.
Which kind of motivates the ASN1, and there's, you know, a certain kind of duality between the state of the system and messages used to control and manipulate it.
That's correct.
But my guess is that you're not going to get a lot of inferential power in terms of representing the messages in OWL. I think it's a useful thing to do in any case. But my understanding kind of from some of your subsequent messages that you were planning on, email messages, was that you're planning on doing the messages, but also trying to capture the underlying domain model that they're interacting with?
Yep.
Okay.
So, yes, that's correct. So, no, you're right. BACnet, as, set itself out as a protocol, strictly on the wire thing. And as we got deeper into it, there was a number of other protocols, specifically Modbus and CAN bus, the Canadian Automation bus, that all had problems with being underspecified in terms of what they were getting and receiving. You know, Modbus is sort of the classic case where you're transferring 16-bit quantities, but you have no idea what format they're in. So you use pairs of registers, and then every vendor describes those 16 or 32-bit values using lots of different kinds of data structures. You know, big Endian, little Endian. There's a couple of different real formats. There's a so the one of the things that BACnet wanted to do up front was to make sure that not only were things like the binary format of specific values being transferred correctly, but there were these things called objects, and that they had known properties. The other thing that it set out to do was to make sure that the devices were discoverable over the wire. So you could take a BACnet device from a particular vendor, maybe an application-specific controller for a variable air volume box, and plug it into your network and turn it on, and completely through network services, find out the configuration of the device as it is exposed, as its data model is exposed. Now, you know, its application code has not been standardized.
Uh-huh.
So there's lots of different vendors that have their programming languages do all kinds of happy, funky things. But BACnet itself is just a transfer model. So now, the interception of this that I want to get to eventually is recognizing how pieces in BACnet that are defined as data model components can be matched up with the facility smart grid and other kinds of web sensor networks. So, you know, I'm struggling with understanding what it means to be a measurement out of the scientific ontologies. You know, when do I actually have a measurement, and when do I have, a derived value? because some of that stuff might be exposed in BACnet and some of it might not be. And of course, the low-hanging fruit is matching up units. So, you know, Steve and Peter, of course, remember the old QMOS days of long ago. You know, my push on getting involved in that was to make sure that when BACnet had a thing called degrees Fahrenheit, that I knew how to match that up with somebody else's version of what it meant to be degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. So that, that's going to get into properties. All right. So let's start with vendor. So is everybody on the vendor page?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's two, the standard, reserves, some pieces for itself, and then reserves some pieces of it for vendor extensions. So what I decided to do is create a vendor class which matches, you know, each of the named individuals within the vendor class would be one of the vendors, and every vendor has a unique vendor identifier that is registered with ASHRAE. So that's a globally unique integer. And
so, just real quick then. So the idea of a vendor class that doesn't explicitly show up in BACnet. You just decided to create that to...
That's correct.
Ah, okay. Now I'm getting the picture.
Okay. So let's see. Where's the... okay. So if you notice... let's see. I'm going to copy this and I'll paste... Okay, if you go into the chat room... there is on the BACnet website, BACnet.org, there is a vendor ID table. Okay, so there's a group of vendors, that particular page has it grouped by the number of vendors within that country. And then down at the bottom of that page is another link that shows a vendor ID table. Okay, and this is the registration process with ASHRAE. You go through the... I don't know. I think it's Stephanie. I think you actually figure out how to get a vendor ID from them. So you'll notice that vendor ID 0 is ASHRAE, and 1 is NIST, and then the rest of them were allocated to the first 20 or so companies that were part of the original standard. And you'll notice that Cornell University is number 15. Okay. So every, you know, vendor has an organization and a contact and an address and some other kinds of things. But more importantly is that the vendor itself is used to group the extensions to the standard that they have defined. Okay? And let's just keep going. Let's hold that thought in your head for a minute. So my first question is, you know, since it's italics at the bottom of the vendor page, is I have a screen, a script that scrapes that website table and turns it into a series of the named individuals like I have defined for ASHRAE. Should I do that as part of the ontology as I present it? In other words, should those named individuals, because they are global unique, be part of the ontology, or should that be something separate?
I would at least put it in a separate data file, not the ontology file, if you're going
to... Okay.
I mean, I think you'll probably want some level of modularity among the ontology files itself. So, I mean, I agree it should be one of them. But this sounds like something that actually could be useful, kind of standalone, separate from the rest of the ontology as well.
Okay.
Okay. You're saying it's permanent. In other words, you don't expect it to change, although I will note, I assume some of that data inside, like the contact person and the addresses, may change.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, the other thing is, ultimately, you may actually be able to get, you know, presumably ASHRAE has a database that's really the authoritative source for that. And, you know, the preferable thing long-term would be basically an interface to their database. So, how big this vendor list is now, but, you know, if you look at MAC addresses on Ethernet, you know, the first 3 bytes are a vendor code, and
yep.
You certainly don't want to load all of the vendor codes for Ethernet.
No, it was actually funny because, you know, ASHRAE had sort of a spreadsheet that was this list,
mm-hmm.
And Mike actually helped maintain the spreadsheet. And so the HTML table was actually the definitive source for this for quite a while until ASHRAE understood the concept of a website, which actually took them quite a while.
So you're saying this is the definitive place. Is that right?
It's as definitive as any other place. I mean, you know, Mike with his role as he's head of the standards group that oversees the standards groups at ASHRAE. So he's in close contact with those folks on a regular basis and maintains that table. So no, I mean, I think I don't know how definitive the table is anymore. You know, I think you're right. I think there is probably a spreadsheet or Microsoft Access database, you know, somewhere on Stephanie's desk that is supposed to be the authoritative version. So anyway, all right. So there's nothing glaringly obviously wrong with the turtle code that I've included there.
The one thing I wasn't quite sure about was whether the vendor class itself was in the vendor namespace. Is used the default namespace for that.
I don't know what you mean.
Oh, okay. So, for example, the vendor ID property.
Yeah.
They're colon vendor ID. Vendor itself is just colon vendor.
Oh yeah. So as Steve has noticed, I make liberal use of prefixes. Let's see. Hang on a sec. Let me. Copy out.
So I was just wondering if you intended vendor to be in a different namespace, if it's intended to be in the same namespace, I would actually make it explicit.
Yeah, in fact, that was my comment, which was I was suggesting that pretty much all of the classes he's defined and stuff should be in the same namespace, same prefix. But
yeah, I was looking at the thread as well. The modules can be useful, but I would actually, if you used the multiple namespaces, I would make each of the namespaces resolvable. So, Okay. Splitting things into multiple files that correspond. Because the resolvability is, often overlooked, but, you know, is really a key of what really makes this a web, ontology versus just a regular ontology or data model.
Okay, let's see. What happened to my... Go ahead, keep going. Sorry.
The problem with that, as he has it now, is each file is only going to have, like, half a dozen lines or something. So...
Some of my spot check look a little bigger, but, yeah, that may not be all that big. So the other thing that's helpful, certainly for end users, is to basically have one sort of top level that basically imports everything. And then...
Yeah.
Users can kind of decide if they want to look at a piece or at a easily get the whole thing.
So up at the top of the TDL files or the RDF files, they're different syntactical versions of the same thing, but they have the XML namespace vendor. As you'll notice, that's a hash namespace as opposed to a slash namespace.
Uh-huh.
Which I do, I tried to sort of establish that as a design principle that all of the things in the hash namespaces are individuals and all the ones in the slashes are classes.
Oh boy. I didn't catch that. Ouch. To be honest, if anything, I would do it the opposite way, but I actually wouldn't suggest mixing the two.
Okay, well, we're going to keep going. I'll show you how that manifests itself in a couple of different ways as we move on here.
Okay.
But I'll take that under advisement.
Okay. All right.
So let's move on to primitive data types.
All right.
Hey, Evan, are you on the call? No, I guess
no, he isn't.
Evan,
I don't know why.
Just in the chat room. Okay.
He isn't just in the chat. No, maybe he is. Hang on. Is that you, Evan?
Yeah, I'm on the call.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Yeah.
You were muted before, maybe.
Right.
Okay, so BACnet has a bunch of primitive data types that you can see listed here. The first one is a null value that's used in both APDU parameters and within the object model to reference different kinds of things, meaning I don't have a value. Or in some cases it means I this is a placeholder for a wildcard for pattern matching. So the I created a null type and a single null named individual to use as the value portion when that shows up in like RDF documents or that kind of thing, or shows up in your graph database.
Yeah, in the cases where, you know, the value is sort of unknown or something, I would try to avoid using that. But when you need to use it as a wildcard, that makes more sense. I mean, the general view of the semantic web languages is that it's open world, so you may not have all the information.
Right.
So, you know, cluttering your view with lots of null values, I think, is probably not what you want to do.
Right, but the classic example from BACnet is a thing called a priority array.
Mm-hmm.
So for analog value objects that have a present value of some number that you can override to have some other value. Now, so let's say that the application uses an analog value of 75 as being the high limit for some discharge air temperature. And you want to be able to override that from some other process, then there is a priority array in the object, which is an array of 16 values, and the current operational value of the point is the value that is in the highest slot number. So the slots either have, you know, in this case, a real or a null. And so you actually write null as an explicit value to clear something out of that priority array.
I might be tempted to change the representation to basically to, you know, index value or something like that. One thing that's going to be a problem here is you actually, I mean, the first thought would be you would define the value to be basically a real or a null.
Yep.
But you actually can't do that because null is a class and real is a data type. And at least not, you could do it in OWL full, but you couldn't, you couldn't do it in LDL.
This is
okay.
Like punning, is that right? Is that what you're saying, Mike?
No, it's not even punning, actually. It's actually mixing essentially data type values and object values.
Mixing categories, you can't do that in DL.
Okay, well, I think that this is going to be a fairly consistent problem throughout this whole deal.
Yeah, well, I was wondering how you're going to handle sequences. I've got some suggestions on that, but
okay.
we'll get to that.
Yep.
Kind of going down to the next one, and I've seen this earlier, the other one. The definition, equivalent class is going to be a problem because XFE Boolean isn't a class.
Well, isn't that but I've defined it as a data type, as an RDFS data type, right?
It's a data type. It's not a class. It's not an OWL class. The domain and range for equivalent class are classes.
Okay. So does that mean that I need to, if I'm going to have something that I want it to have a Boolean value, should I declare a Boolean class that has, like, RDF value?
I would probably just use, in terms of your mapping, just use XFE Boolean where it's appropriate to use it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the clearest thing, rather than trying to do these mappings. You know, if you could probably get away with doing an OWL same as, but that kind of doesn't, you know.
Okay.
That could work, but I don't think you unless there's some real esoteric data types here that you want to precisely record the mapping, I think I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, in fact, let me add I endorse that. And if you're thinking of mapping to the FSGIM standard, that's exactly what we've done. For, in those cases where there are XSD data types, we adopt those, and we have a whole package which is common primitive types and enumerations where we define any other primitive data types we need. So the mapping would be very straightforward for the half dozen XSD data types we just use.
Huh. Well, yeah. I'm not sure how that's going to work. All right. Well, okay. We'll keep going, and I'll hold on to that thought.
Yeah, the other option would be to actually define them essentially as derived data types from the corresponding XSDs. But, you know, I think for folks that are used to XSDs, having the direct the direct type in there is clearer.
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder how that's going to work itself out. Okay. All right. Well, let's keep going. Let's see. So,
I had one other thought that I meant to actually ask there. You know, to the extent that you can, you know, I think sort of separating out kind of the ASN1 specific kind of processing, and maybe with an eye toward generalizing it for other ASN1 applications, you know, would be a very useful contribution to the community as a separate tool. So you might want to think about that anyway. I know that they use a little bit of, you know, that it maybe isn't quite pure ASN1 or there's some additional things that you need to filter out. But and I looked a little bit to see if there was an existing ASN1 to RDF converter, and I didn't find it, although I'm not familiar with the proprietary ASN1 tools.
And actually, there is some work going on in NIST in that regard. They took one of the medical standards, 11073, IEEE 11073, and trying to remember the name of the vendor, but it's a contractor over in ITL, Information Technology Lab, who did, in fact, convert this rather huge ASN.1 encoded standard and wrote some scripts to pull out, it was a PDF document, which was documenting the ASN.1 spec, and he used a script to pull all the tables out of the PDF document and started reconstructing, essentially, a UML file out of it. And then
is that Prometheus?
Prometheus, exactly. Prometheus Computing. So those guys did that, and then I took the UML and turned it into OWL, so it was a kind of a multi-step process.
Mike and everybody else, I mean, the recommendations you gave, could you try to capture that onto the chat so that we have some proceeding and fruits out of the clinic captured?
Yeah, I'll try to do that.
Okay, out and use existing data sets. So the first really more difficult of the ASN1 structures is a BACnet bit string. So if you could scroll down about a third of the way down the page, there's an example of a BACnet event transition bits, which has 3 bits defined, 2 off-normal, 2 fault, and 2 normal. Which are encoded in BACnet as packed arrays of bits. So what I thought I would do is have a bitstring class, and each of the individual bits having some nominal value.
Hmm.
So the question is, in an ontology, how do you define a thing that is a bit as part of a larger data structure? You know, and this sort of same design pattern shows up with enumerations. As, you know, if you scroll down a little bit farther down to where the enumeration class is defined, then you'll notice that I have enumeration values that have a nominal value property, which is the binding between the enumeration name and its wire encoding. So I, you know, I sort of follow the same design pattern in both cases, but what I, there isn't any array in OWL that I can find.
There isn't. The closest thing is RDF list.
Yeah.
It's a little bit on the edge, because it's, you know, really primarily part of the syntax, but it's the only thing that actually gives you ordered and also closed lists. What I often do is actually, subclass RDF list. So,
okay. Like
if you had a, you know, vendor list or something, a vendor code list or something like that, you basically, specify a more restrictive, first and, first and next property on it.
Yeah.
Using restrictions.
So I defined bitstring as RDF bag, right, which is supposed to be an unordered list, at least out of RDF terms. Is that correct?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't think I've ever seen RDF bag actually used.
Okay.
It's kind of a, and I don't know that it's really addressed explicitly at OWL, so it may get, it's probably the right sentiment, but I'm not even sure if you mentioned the OWL spec.
Well, except that it's unordered. I mean, there's nothing in principle stopping you from defining a class called a bitstring, and then it could have a bunch of other entities defined, which are like a bit with a bit index, for example, or something that tells you where in the string it is, and
right.
Nominal value.
Right. So I have the bit defined correctly, right? Because the bit is just an object that has a nominal value.
Right. And it can have an index.
Right. But what I don't know is how to say that some specific kind of bit string contains these specific bits.
Well,
I assume you also want to basically capture the name, like record access and stream access.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, that's most of the meaning of a bit.
Right, that's right.
I mean, what you may want to do is to actually essentially just make some booleans in your model. And then capture with annotations or something like that the actual bit positions and what larger field they're incorporated in. There is an XML schema data type for binary data. I don't know if that really fits. My guess is it probably doesn't fit here, but.
No, I have that, I use that up above as an octet string.
Okay.
Which,
that makes sense.
It would fit if you could use facets properly. I'm not sure you can.
All right, so moving on to enumerations.
Okay.
So, enumerations are again, you know, you see the ASN1 definition up at the top, and there are two different major classifications of enumerations that aren't explicitly defined in the standard, but are sort of implicitly there if you read enough clauses. And those that are the ones that are defined in the standard, and the ones that are defined by vendors that have their own relationship between, you know, labels and values. And then there are two different types of enumerations in the standard, those that have a limited set of name value pairs and those that also can be extended by vendors with their own name value pairs.
The first one you can use a one of, the second one you can't.
Right, that's correct.
Okay.
So,
I was just going to say, the FSGIM committee just finished a rather extensive discussion about extensible enumerations, where the idea is the vendors or other authorities would extend an enumeration. Mm-hmm. And they came up with a structure, so you might want to just consider that. And, in fact, it incorporates the ISO code list notions. Evan has heard Ed Barkmeyer talk about code lists, and so, you know, we exactly dealt with this particular problem, if you want to just use the FSGIM solution.
Right. Yeah, the problem with that, well, for one thing, is the stuff that was happening in that solution is around web services, not around the core BACnet data model. So the web services part of BACnet has very little to do with the core part of BACnet. it has its own labels and its own data model and its own transfer syntax, right, via SOAP.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in fact, completely, well, there is a little bit of overlap because there is an annex to an addendum that describes how to encode BACnet content using the web services data model, but it really is a separate data model.
But I'm just talking about the notion of an extensible enumeration.
Okay. All right. They're doing that out of XML schema, right?
No. The FSGIM folks, they're just doing it they're doing it in UML, but
Right, but the meeting that just happened at NIST is they're transferring that content into XML.
I wasn't referring to that meeting.
Yeah, he was talking about FSGIM, not BACnet.
Okay.
So, yeah, Evan, you could expound if you like, but we're confronting the very issue of there may be multiple extensible enumerations, which we didn't want to have in the actual standard, but we wanted to support the existence of. And that was the idea of a named code list, which would be the enumeration, and then the elements of that code list would be whatever that authority chose to put in it, to describe their own enumeration.
Okay, well, I've tried to describe exactly that here by having extended enumeration as a subclass of the standard one, and then having the vendor functional property reference the vendor that described that extension, either through proprietary or an extended enumeration.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at you.
And Joel, I assume then you have separate files basically for each vendor.
Yep.
And a given user would probably just load the vendors that they cared about in their application.
Yep, that's the intent.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so to show a specific example of one of these enumerations is the idea of a property identifier. And a property identifier is on the wire, of course, it's just an integer that describes what property it is you want to read or write, or which property is changing state or changing value. So a property identifier by itself, of course, the BACnet standard describes a whole series of properties in an enumeration. And that has defined values, and then reserves for itself, 0 to 511, for the sort of, the ASHRAE space, if you will. And then from 512, up to the rest of a 32-bit space, available for vendors to be able to add their own property identifiers. So if I am a vendor, then I can make a new property identifier and add that property to both standard objects and proprietary objects. And by using an identifier, using value 512 and having it implicitly described as the vendor, then you can actually resolve what kind of thing this is that I'm talking about.
So Joel, one of the things I'm wondering about is just actually, you know, modeling property identifiers separately versus just making them OWL properties.
Well, I mean, I didn't think that I could necessarily describe something. Once we get into structured data, then we'll talk about property identifiers in the context of how they're used in properties. So there's another layer I get to before I get there, and that's on the next page.
Okay. All right.
So hold that thought.
Okay.
So the first thing is how to understand what a property identifier is and all the different types of property identifiers that appear. And capturing that information that is buried in various different clauses in the standard. It's particularly hard to find. You have to read pretty deep before you can find it. So here I'm putting that content up front. So date and times are simple. They're just patterns of values. I'm just matching what BACnet has as 4 octets. I'm just converting those into strings, and I think that's going to be close enough.
Can you map it to the full ISO 8601 or something? I mean, I realize it's richer than the XFC data types because it allows wildcards.
Yeah, that's right. You can't do it because of the wildcards.
But 8601 is a little broader, although I don't remember if it actually supports wildcards or not.
Last time I read it, it did not. But I'm not quite sure that I captured all that. So, in BACnet, there are differences between UTC date and times and date time objects, which are collections of a date thing and a time thing bundled together. We'll probably won't get quite that deep into the rest of this today, but. In some cases, specifically as they were mapping content to BACnet Web Services, and they wanted to make sure that the APIs that people were using to talk web services to BACnet devices would be able to use regular, sort of native date and times, then those things have been, the sort of the models have been mapped so that the XML schema model version that you're talking to using web services sort of loosely translates into the BACnet model, but they're not a one-to-one translation because there's restrictions about what can appear and what can't appear. Now, there's also restrictions on whether or not dates and times can contain wildcards as part of the what I would consider the core model, but it's not at all clear where those show up, and a lot of the cases of the support questions that have come into the BACnet mailing lists have been trying to figure out whether or not a wildcard date and time is appropriate in that particular type of APD or that particular data model. So that kind of thing is still being negotiated within the group.
So, I mean,
and wildcard here really means any value, right? So. If you just wanted to do something on every Tuesday, you would the other 3 fields would be wildcarded.
That's correct.
But you want to align your date use of a date printer data type with 8601 or another possible ontological definition thereof, right?
I don't necessarily care about that at this layer. Once you move up into higher layers of abstraction, when you're getting away from the nitty gritty of BACnet itself and trying to describe what that means.
I see.
If you have a schedule object that has a list of start and stop times for a device, that can be specified as part of the BACnet data model, but it can also be described as some other kind of thing, maybe out of WS Calendar or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. As I was going to say, you might as well, once you're doing this in hour, you might as well start to take advantage of the open world of models assumption and import things that have been carefully thought through already.
Right. I don't know. I would really have to sit down with a WS Calendar expert to know whether or not everything that's in BACnet can be mapped correctly and how to do that.
Mm-hmm. That might be worth it because Otherwise, it's just going to have to happen later.
I definitely believe it has to happen. I can't do it now because I can barely wrap my head around this turtle stuff.
Well, so what are you trying to do with this, though? That maybe I just came in too late to understand. Because it seems to me if you wanted to use reasoning from OWL, you'd want to use Texas D-Date time. But it doesn't, of course, support these patterns of the repeating every Tuesday.
Right. So the parts of OWL are... I'm trying to use OWL as a formalism to describe BACnet. Not necessarily, because I don't understand what the reasoning capabilities would actually buy me as an ontology designer. I don't quite know. All I can mentally take on right now is try to map the things that I recognize and understand out of the BACnet data model into something that's at least close. You know, if there's other kinds of higher level work, like I know that we want to work on this in relationship to the W3C sensor model or the scientific thing or the building information model out of the green building guys, but I can't remember the guys that come up with the BIM.
Yeah.
But there's some OASIS work, and I know that there's the geospatial consortium for location information that I would like to eventually merge this into, but I knew that I couldn't take on the process of working with those other relationships without first knowing that I had something that was useful that represented BACnet, at least as close as we could.
Yeah, well, I guess what I was trying to understand is what useful was. So just formalizing it is what your objective is here.
Yep. And formalizing in a way that doesn't break OWL, you know, or that doesn't violently abuse OWL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I thought that in terms of, I could describe all this using just RDF, but I thought that that wasn't necessarily as useful as it would be as if I was describing this using OWL.
But so your intention is that... Then later on, you or a group or something will go in and substitute chunks of this with pieces that might be popularly used to describe various things. Is that right?
Right. So, you know, so if I have a schedule object in BACnet that's got its own little bits and pieces and components, that there is some translation mechanism or some, you know, some glue ontology that can take something out of WS Calendar and out of BACnet and marry the two together using something probably not quite as powerful as OWL Sing as.
Well, it might be subclass, for example. You might just specialize a WS Calendar class or something.
Right.
Okay.
Evan, does that help?
Sure.
Okay.
Please continue.
I put a note in the chat that at some point in the future you might want to look at OWL Time, the OWL Time ontology, for capturing some of these things. But I think that's it sounds like what you're doing now is reasonable.
Okay. All right. So the next piece underneath time is object identifier.
So I'm sorry. A couple, several examples kind of going down here. You basically have a structure where you define a data type and then make it equivalent to another data type. I would just use that name directly for the data type that you're defining.
You
would just say colon date, RDF data type, OWL on data type, ecstasy string, with restriction. So you don't need an extra layer in there.
Okay. A lot of this is because I wrote it in the OWL functional syntax. And then ran through the Manchester translation, and then gave it to Steve, who ran it through, top quadrant something?
Yeah, top grade composer, yeah.
Yeah, top grade composer. Mm-hmm. So the TDL files that you see here are the output of top grade that has been retranslated from the stuff that I originally wrote.
Okay, all right. But, I would, like I said, the equivalent class is likely to be somewhat problematic, I think, and... There's no reason to just make a name thing equivalent to an unnamed thing. It's easier to just make it name to begin with.
Okay, so like object name down at the bottom of that page?
Well, even date. It's the same thing. You just use the lower four, you know, the lower four lines as the prop copy object for date.
In fact, I was going to ask that anyway. There was something going on when it brought it in. You seemed to be using equivalent class a lot, and I wasn't quite sure. It seemed to be being used for declaring properties, and I wasn't quite sure what was going on there.
Well, I mean, as I read through the OWL functional syntax specification, that was sort of the examples that they had, and I just matched those examples.
So what do you mean by declaring properties? Steve?
What do I mean?
What do you mean? I mean, because in fact, that is the way. If you're talking about classes, in class description, the only way, there's two ways, right? You can either make the property make it the domain, or you can make a restriction and then make something equivalent to it.
Yeah. Give me a few minutes, you guys can keep talking, and I'll find some examples that I thought were odd in the
file. You know, data types are different than classes. So.
Right. Oh, okay, well, here's one. It's the error class I'm just looking at, which has equivalent classes of device, object, property, resources, security, services, and VT.
Where is? I'm sorry.
It's the enumeration. It's the possible values of the error class enumeration.
Oh, it's the all values from? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Hang on.
All values from. Well, maybe it's some values from, depending on the required cardinalities and things. But
either way,
anyway,
it sounds like a restriction to me.
Yeah, it's basically possible values, right? These are enumerations of possible values, like door alarm state has equivalent class to six or eight different things. And I just, I guess I hadn't encountered. Is that what you're talking about, Evan? Is that the valid use of the equivalent class relationship?
No, I don't understand the example. I don't have access to it.
Yeah, I think. Steve, the typical example would be if you actually want to associate a property restriction with a name. So, for instance, if you want to say that a man is someone who has the property gender with a value of M.
Well, it's more like, let's say door alarm state only had, or door state has two values, open and closed. I don't know if that's true, but anyway. Yeah, open, closed, and unknown, three values.
So there you can just say door state, all one out of, and then list the values.
Yeah, or say all values from, and then...
No, I actually meant to say, I meant to say one out rather than all values from in that case.
So I just pasted the OWL XML version of door status into the chat area.
Okay, let's see here.
Thank you.
Door status. Okay, I'm just trying to read through here now. Yeah, it actually doesn't convey the restriction that we want. I think it's saying it's got to be one of these three. So you could do it either way, I think, Mike. You could do all values from this or that or the other, or you could say one of this or that or that. But it shows up in the turtle file as an equivalence class.
Right.
And that's weird. I don't know if it was just the translation that made it end up that way.
Well, I mean, your translation was from the RDF document, right? Or was
that's
it from
right.
the OWL XML file?
I think it was from the RDF. I had no trouble chewing on the OWL one, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when I started this work, I started with the code that I just pasted into the chat room, the OWL functional syntax.
Right.
Which saying that the door status was one of those specific enumerations.
Right. And automation you know, our various translations, I think, is not serving us well here in terms of constructing the turtle structure.
Okay. So, you know, here is why I say that the door status closed is a named individual that is the specific relationship between the label closed and the value zero for that enumeration.
The one, my guess is the top quadrant may be internalizing into a data model and then serializing their internal data model.
I don't know.
What may work better is if you use Jenna at the RDF level. So Jenna, and they actually have a Jenna RDF copy command that'll let you convert easily between different representations, not including LXML. That may be a little more direct. Yeah, that's really a triple level transformation rather than any higher level.
Yeah, that might work. That's right.
Okay, so can I follow up with you sometime later next week on how to actually do that?
I can. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. I'll put another chat as well.
Okay, thank you. All right, so the next snarling piece of BACnet is an object identifier, which it defines as a primitive data type, which is a 32-bit packed binary value that has two fields in it, a 10-bit object identifier, a 10-bit object type, and a 22-bit instance number. So analog value 0 will have one 32-bit representation, you know, and binary value 3 will have another representation on the wire. So I described object identifier as a class that has these two functional properties, one of which is a reference to an object type, which is an enumeration, and the other one is the instance number, which is just a restriction on integers to make sure that they stay in the right range.
Let's see now. Yeah. You're saying the domain, I'm just trying to read through this thing. The domain is object identifier and the range is object type?
Yeah, so object identifiers have a type and instance as two functional properties. The domain of both is object identifier, right? I mean, that sort of makes sense. And then the range of the type references an enumeration, and the range of the instance is a number.
So namespace OID, this is your namespace, right? You declared that?
Yeah, that prefix OID is my prefix for object identifier.
OID type. Wow. So you declared something which is an instance of a functional property which you are calling type, right?
Right. I'm calling it type because the standard calls it type.
That's going to be confusing, but okay. As you can see in that line itself, of course, you're using the RDF definition of type is already well established, and then you've got this other thing.
Right. It is a little confusing, but once you realize what he's doing, you can tell.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll copy here just the first part of object type. Out of the file. Okay. That smiley face is actually a colon O. Sorry.
Okay, yeah.
That's the chat room translation. All right.
Actually, you can turn off the smiley on the chat in the chat room.
Oh,
yeah.
That would be good because, it was up above. I guess in parse type, I guess, the P is sticking out your tongue. okay. So the
object types are standard enumerations because you can't define your own object type. Well, let's see, there's two parts of object types, right? There's an extended object type because vendors can describe their own objects. And then there's a standard object type, which is one of the reserved enumeration values for those things. Okay, so analog input is a specific label out of the enumeration for object type. And so when the object type value in when the object type property of an object has value 0, then you know that it is an analog input. But if you're in one of the vendor ranges, then you have to look to the vendor to figure out what kind of object this is. So if the object type is, say, 712, defined from Allerton, then you have to look to Allerton's definition of what 712 is. Otherwise, you might have to look at Automated Logic's version of 712 or Johnson Control's version of what 712 is. So the reserved object types are known, are well known and defined in the standard, and then the extended object types are ones that vendors can create for themselves.
I think it would seem I'd be more comfortable anyway, but this is just my thought. If you didn't have so many namespaces, then this wouldn't be quite as dangerous sort of defining your own classes that are presumed, which are standard names of classes out there anyway. If you had one, you know, BACnet, colon, and then you do a lot of stuff in the BACnet namespace, it'd be more recognizable.
Okay, well, I mean, I'd be happy to remove all my happy custom prefixes. you know, that's a really easy script change.
Actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
Things like this OID, you know, that you type within BACnet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm.
So my...
Do you agree, Mike?
I would agree, yeah. I mean, I think it adds to the clarity, you know, as long as the size for the individual, well, you could still use the modules with the same names that you could still, decompress it into multiple files and import them and just have them all use the same, namespace.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, well, no, again, you know, these prefixes, I defined, because it was easier for me to, you know, sort of edit these text files by hand.
Right.
And I didn't have so many copy and paste errors. But as I move into, I don't know, higher functional tools, you know, like I can convince Cornell to buy me a copy of Top Grade Composer, then, you know, I'll be happier to use a lot fewer custom prefixes.
There is an issue, though, with collision, because I noticed that several of the things had security failure, for instance, as a value.
That's
one specific example.
Where is that? I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's see if I can find it. If I have the. So I was looking at the file that you sent out yesterday, Joel.
Okay.
And let's see. So. I don't remember quite whether what the relic is. Yeah.
Well, security level, security policy?
I don't know. I mean, it's just basically, I think there are duplicate value sets among the enumerations. I think there are duplicates among the different enumeration sets.
Oh, there may be same enumeration names used in more than one enumeration.
Right.
That is definitely the case. So if you look at this as just the label after the hash sign, then you're definitely going to see name collisions.
Right.
Those are actually defined as separate kinds of individuals because they mean separate things depending on which enumeration they're a part of.
Right. And if you put everything in one namespace, you're going to lose that.
Oh, but I wouldn't suggest the extendable enumerations, which would presumably point to different governing authorities, possibly, or different vendors, anyway.
Yep.
Those would have to be distinguished from each other.
Right. I think that's even separate. I think basically just in the standard set, there are examples here.
I thought
that security failure was what I remembered, but. Maybe I'm mistaken on exactly how that was spelled.
And by the way, just to go back just a minute, I was rereading Joel's posting of the RDF file, and I'm not sure the Jenna translator is going to help you because even in the RDF it says equivalent class.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah, sure. Already using equivalent class there. I don't think there was any insertion of a, de facto model or anything there.
Well, no, right, because what I did is I took the OWL functional stuff and I ran it through the Manchester translator and then, transliterated the template that of the results that I got back. I didn't try to understand this at any deeper level.
I don't know why it was using equivalent class there. It seems an odd construct, that's all.
Okay. Well, it's not the first odd construct you'll see in here.
Yeah. So let's see. So the property is actually called security error. So it's used. I'm about to type up the chat question.
Oh, and that's an abort reason.
Well, it's also an error code.
Under error code, yeah, I see that there.
Yep, and it's also an error code, yep.
So,
there's a difference in BACnet between error and abort.
Okay, but I'm just saying, the use of multiple namespaces protects you from potential duplicates there. If you don't, then you need to either manually deconflict it or view it as a symbol and that has both types. Which might not necessarily be a huge problem. Presumably they're somewhat consistent in terms of the two usages, but.
Yep. All right, so we're going to run out of time here, so I need to move forward. Okay, so let's go on to constructed data types. Which is the constructed.html.
Got it. Back up here.
I put a link to it in the chat room.
Okay.
All right, so this is where the stuff actually gets controversial. Everything up till now is pretty straightforward, I thought. But now it gets kind of nasty. There are three different kinds of data structures for building more complex object values. So most of the objects in BACnet have properties that are primitive data types, like the object name is a string, and the object type is an enumeration, and the present value is a Boolean or a number. Okay, so most of those are primitives. However, there are properties that have sub-properties,
mm-hmm.
essentially. They're constructed data types.
Okay.
So there are three of those. There, and the labels for this, sequence, sequence of, and choice, come right out of the ASN1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So a sequence can be thought of as like a C-style structure that can have optional pieces. A sequence of is like a list or array, and a choice, which is one of a set of optional elements. Okay, so each one of these things are composed of elements. So I, you know, if you just kind of scan through the top level of this page, you know, I describe what an element is and then how sequences are made up of sequence elements, which are a kind of element, and then choices have choice elements. And then there's the weird one, any, at the bottom. Okay. So every element, I mean, you know, if you think about this in C programming, then every element of a structure has a name and has a data type. In BACnet, they not only have a data type, so you see down at the bottom of the element where it says element colon data type refers to an element doesn't actually have a range because I haven't figured out how to describe that. But it has unlike C structures where every structure is defined and required, in BACnet, sequence elements can be optional. And because we're defining this as a stream protocol with optional elements, then there has to be some way to distinguish between them. So they use these things called context tags.
So this is all ASN1, right?
Right. This is a combination of ASN1 and why the ASN1 like that is used in BACnet encoding. I'm trying to cover both concepts. Okay, because BACnet uses ASN1 as the text portion, but doesn't use BER, the basic encoding rules. It has its own encoding rules. So you'll see lots of places in BACnet where something is defined as ASN1 and then says, by the way, it does not use ASN1.
well, wait a minute. I mean, ASN1 is how you specify the abstract syntax. How you encode it is your choice. BER is just one of multiple ways that you can encode.
Right, that's right. But there are some things that are described in ASN1 that don't match up with BACnet things. Okay.
This is the interesting stuff.
So if you scroll down to the example of an ASN1 sequence, which is the sequence piece in the middle of the page, then that has three parts, right? The first two of which are unsigned integers, and then the second part is a more complicated data structure, which has its own internal pieces. Okay, so the BACnet channel value is described in ASN1 as another sequence.
Mm.
Okay, so you can have sequences of sequences.
So, Joel, is the 1.16, is that basically an array, or is that...
No, that's a value restriction.
Oh, that's that. Okay, I see. Okay.
So the channel number is an unsigned 16, which means it's a 16-bit value. And the overriding priority has to be a number between 1 and 16.
Okay.
But it's optional, right? So if you look at this as bits on the wire, then the first unsigned is going to be context-encoded 0, and then if the next piece is there, it's going to be context-encoded 1.
Okay.
But that piece might not be there. The decoder might have to move straight on to the BACnet channel value decoding for that component of that sequence. So I think that sequences can be of a subclass of RDF sequence, but I'm not quite sure. And I'm not sure that we can answer that question just yet.
Yeah, Evan, do you remember, I mean, I don't remember Owl itself actually talking about sequences and bags.
No, it doesn't, but there was this business of having a shadow vocabulary to support some of that stuff. But the whole idea of supporting structured data types in Owl, it's just not done.
Yeah.
You end up having to build classes to support most of them. So that's why I find this whole question is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of capturing a slightly different data model in at a meta level here. an owl and a Mandarin Moonlight Primitive, you could easily generate passing properties directly from it.
So the standard defines two different types of sequence elements, those that are required and those that are optional. So I just happily create a pair of disjoint subclasses, just because I think it would be interesting on the documentation level. this is where sort of this translates from being a data model to being an information model, right? Is these little pieces here that describe the way BACnet treats these sequence elements. The sequence element itself has an index, which is a position within the sequence, which is separate from the context identifier that it inherits from the base element class. Because not everything that is context encoded 0 is the first thing in the list. You can have a whole variety of sequence elements collected together, and then only up until the point where you have a conflict between required and optional sequence elements that are of the same data type that you would context encode them.
By the way, you know, we were talking earlier about bit strings with an index property, for example.
Yep.
And this is where I just put something on the chat where you're now tying the use of the index term to sequence elements because you've defined a domain and a range. In general, you might consider not using domain and range at all, and then you could use index in this context with a restriction class of the sequence element, and then you could use index in the bitstring situation with a different restriction class on how it's used.
Yeah, but for me, those are two different kinds of uses because
That's one, right. Is
structural position, and the other one is I would say nominal position. I mean, I don't think I always struggle with the difference between ordinal, cardinal, and nominal.
but they both would have a non-negative integer, for example,
right?
As range. So in that sense, conceptually, they're the same notion of an index. But you'd have to now invent a different word for the index in the bit stream because you've already used up. Well, of course, you could use the same word index because you've got a different namespace. But it's just in general, I've sort of been encouraged to use restriction classes rather than domain and range.
I was debating whether to raise that issue as well, but I definitely use restrictions rather than domain and range, you know, primarily because of that. Kind of reuse potential.
Yeah.
And I mean, so vendor ID was maybe is reasonably specific, but you find things like name, there's lots of name things.
Yeah.
And, it's really nice to be able to reuse.
Otherwise, you're going to have just a proliferation of properties. All over the place.
Right.
Anyway, I wrote it up in the chat so you can capture it.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. So let's see. Sequence of is to be treated as a lot like a C-style structure, where it is, it's just in the case where I have a BACnet security key set, which is just a sequence of BACnet key identifiers, that's sort of an unbounded list of these that is context encoded 3 in a particular message or in the list of things that are part of an object. So the security key set as a sequence redefined as a piece of another larger component. But anyway, the idea here is just that it's I'm debating about moving away from the ASN1 label of sequence of into something that would be closer to what a programmer might recognize as a list. Because I think list of something is a lot cleaner to, you know, label than the ASN1 term of sequence of.
Well, list actually is probably a really good place to use a separate namespace for ASN1. So you could actually use, you know, ASN1 colon sequence of, and that could be really standalone in terms of the ASN1 concepts from BACnet.
Okay.
So that I think would be a really good idea, you know, even if the code isn't separated there.
Okay.
The other suggestion I was going to make is that I would probably look at using RDF list instead of RDF sequence.
Okay.
Because that's got at least a little more standing in OWL. And you can also use, by putting restrictions on specific things, you can type it.
Okay.
So a list of, you know, sequence of BACnet. Well, I would do BACnet key identifier list as a subclass of RDF list.
Yep, okay. Let's see. Oh, and inside RDF list, how do you say that all of the list members have to be of a certain class?
You use null values from restriction on the, what's it called? RDF.
It's RDF null first, right?
First, right, yeah.
But you can't do that on, well, I mean, how do you put a restriction on a property that is used in more than one class and have that restriction limited to just that class?
Because it's class specific. If you use subclass of, you can think of it as being this class that I'm defining now is one of the things that has a name that's a string, for example.
Okay.
That's how it is used.
Right.
Okay.
It is class specific.
Right. Now, okay. If you use equivalent class, it's bidirectional, it's a little different, but if for Hackathon 5, I guess, you know, I did generate a bunch of turtle files that kind of make a lot of use of restrictions in particular.
Basically, the property definition stands on its own without any restrictions, and then when a class invokes that property in an association, that's how you do it, as a subclass, restriction subclass.
Okay. Could you email me an example of that when you get a chance?
Sure.
Okay, great. I mean, I understand what you're saying at a conceptual level, but I'm not familiar enough with the syntactical translation that I can picture what the text would look like.
Okay.
But do you want an example operating on the RDF list?
What's that?
I mean, there's plenty of general examples of this, but does he want this particularly dealing with the RDF list?
Oh, well, that's harder. I'm just going to give him some random example.
I could probably type that in. Or.
Okay. All right, so choices is the like the BACnet recipient. We're now closer down to the bottom of that HTML page. And that's like a data structure that can have only one of those defined for any instance. So a BACnet recipient can either be an object BACnet object identifier or a BACnet address, but it can't be both. In this case that I've shown here, both of those choices are context encoded, but they are not always context encoded. In BACnet, if the choice values are one of a number of primitive data types, then they will probably not be context encoded. And a classic case is what we talked about earlier for the priority array, where the priority value can either be an integer or null. Then that is where I'm using that null value as a direct reference to a named individual that means null.
Hmm.
So I have no idea how to describe choice in OWL so that any one of the choices can be selected, but not more than one of them.
Oh, he has a cardinality restriction.
No, cardinality restrictions is on the instance of a thing, right? I mean, I can put a cardinality restriction on device as a property of BACnet recipient.
Okay.
So that you can only specify one device, but I can't set it so that you can set either a device or an address, but not both.
Well, if you have a cardinality restriction of one and you have the all values from restriction of this or that,
right,
then once you pick one, you can't pick the other.
Okay. So all values, well, is this an all values from, or is this an all objects from, or is this a...
It would be an all values from, because you're saying everything on the other end of this property must be from this other class or this other class, this class A or class B.
Okay.
And furthermore, you're saying the cardinality restriction says there must be one.
Right.
Okay.
So in conjunction with a union, an OWL union.
Right. Right. The union actually in the range definition.
Mm. Right. That's correct. In the all values, well, I wouldn't use
that. Well, yeah, in the thing that's on the end of the all values, yeah.
Correct.
In the...
I'll give you an example of that while I've given you an example of the syntax.
Okay, so
model where I use that.
So let's see, if I have
I'm gonna paste one thing in the chat just for fun. It's a there. Very last subclass restriction class has a union of
Okay, we're
so a bunch of those have cardinality restrictions of one. One of them has a all values from. This is a medical reading, so a medical reading of a patient, see all values from patient. And the bottom one says the it's basically saying, let's see, restriction on the place is either a location or a postal address. One or the other, but not both.
On, it is a union of all values from place.
Place is the relation, yeah.
Hmm.
So
okay.
That's the property. Place.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, wait a minute. Let me read my own stuff here. On property.
So kind of the key thing to remember is that a restriction is a subclass of class. So it's basically defining a class of object more on their characteristics rather than just by name.
Okay.
The postal address is the name class. The other one is saying basically something that has a place associated with it.
Oh,
okay. It has a place associated with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh. All right. Well, I will post versions of this as the choices appear in the standard, and then maybe we can, you know, re-review this at another time and see if I got the syntax right.
I just posted this example as well. It's a list with first limited to be back in identifier and the rest on the identifier list.
Right.
Okay.
Two properties, each with an all values from, right?
Okay, so the all values from could actually be I mean, that's a class specification, right? I mean, that doesn't have to be a named class. That can be one of these OWL constructions.
Right.
Yeah, it's very common.
You can think of it as basically a local version of Rage.
Okay.
Or a class-specific version thing.
All right, so let's see. The last one is the so-called any type. And this is where things get really nasty. If you look, scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, then you'll see a BACnet object property value. These object property values structures are passed over the wires and maintained as arrays of these things and lists of these things inside other parts of the BACnet data model. So these appear in lots of different places. And structures that are like this, for example, there's another one that has device object property value, which includes a device identifier on top of all this. So there's a lot of different variations of this same structure. But the point is that the value part, which is context tagged 3, can be anything that is described in BACnet. It can be a primitive data type. It can be another structure. It can be a list of primitive data types or a list of other structures that are either optionally or context encoded. And now what do I do?
Yeah, I think that's right. Or just essentially not specifying a range or an all value stuff.
Because I mean, my original intent was to collect together all of the primitive data types into sort of one metaclass, and all of the and then have all of the different structured data types collected together, and then any can be, one of those.
Yeah.
Out of that unit of those two.
Again, you're trying to mix classes and data types, which don't naturally mix. So, I mean, in Java, you'd use box classes, but that's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. In Python, I can do all kinds of fancy things, but I can't do that in OWL.
But you can't do it in LDL.
Right. If you're going outside, then you can use the same property with both literal and instance values.
So if you scroll all the way up to the top of that page where I have constructed data as one of those members, that's what I was trying to capture the concept that something is constructed data if it is a class that's a member, that's a subclass of one of these three. So I was treating those classes as individuals, and I don't know if you can do that. Can you do that?
Well, that's what punning is all about when you start
making
an individual class behave like an individual.
Why don't you just think of each subclasses of constructed data?
Because I wanted to be able to say that the any down at the bottom could be one of these constructed or primitive data types. Mm. You know, I was trying to wrap my head around how to specify the range for any. And, you know, and it could be either a primitive or a constructed data type. And that's also why I described null as a class, because I wanted to be able to have a metaclass that represented a group of all of the primitive data type classes. But again, you know, real and Boolean, of course, are data types, so I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's, you know, beyond what is actually necessary to be useful.
My guess is it is. I mean, I guess one question, I assume you're going to want to use this to pull in, you know, live instance data from, you know, running systems and things.
Yep, absolutely.
And at that level, probably the meta information is less, at least at this level, is probably less important.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I'm going to be running all kinds of queries about, you know, Cornell's building automation control system, you know, as a fairly good sized directed graph. Let's see, we got 20 minutes.
One kind of question. This is the kind of thing that could certainly be recorded kind of in comments in the ontology. For example, one of the issues with most of the ontology tools is that they tend to reorder everything and not render stuff that, you know, in comments. What I do, although I don't recommend it to everyone, but it sounds like you may be a user there, as appropriate users, is to write it in something like Turtle and then translate it, and then essentially the authoritative version is really the text file.
Okay.
So I tend to use Prodigy and TopGrade to validate and visualize, but not actually to edit these things.
Yeah,
wow,
then you can do a, you know, CDSDF and things like that as well.
Yeah.
And really see what the changes were.
So Steve, out of the TDL file that is on the project page now, is exactly one of those where all of the subcomponents have been reordered out of the file that you gave me, and collected together into common unions. So you know, if there was a class definition followed by a bunch of its properties, then those were collected together, rather than being spread out through the file like what you gave me out of what TopRaid produced.
Right. Okay. Yeah, there are very different settings on how it would serialize the file anyway, but I think you're right in the sense that there's no guarantees.
Right, and I found it particularly frustrating of most of the conversion tools that it took all of my RDF annotations and threw those, you know, way down at the bottom. I was like, geez, you know, I really need those next to the class definitions to figure out which of the hell class I'm working on.
Right.
So, anyway, I completely understand that.
Right. Well, that's true. Mike's taking a hardcore approach of, writing the Turtle himself. So, but it has that advantage of being able to keep track of stuff.
All right. Next topic. Object. All right. So is everybody on the object page?
Object page. Did you send a link to that?
Object.html at the top. It's just a... Yep, hang on. There, links in the chat room.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Okay, so it was about 2:30 in the morning by the time I finally went to bed, so everywhere it says this is a long line of text is going to be some beautifully well-written prose. But I couldn't get that part done for the hackathon, but I thought that if we could at least look at this, as a sort of annotated version of the Turtle file. I'm convinced that I'm using Sphinx for all this project documentation, and I'm convinced that I can morph Sphinx into understanding Turtle files to generate HTML and EPUB and LaTeX and all that. So I'm looking forward to that eventually. I think that'll be cool.
What is Sphinx? Is it a content management system, or is it a...
It's a document building system. So it uses kind of like Wiki Markup. It's called Restructured Text. But it has lots of cool things like, especially for documenting code. It was originally written for documenting Python code because it turns all of your class names and function names into cross-reference hyperlinks between things. So I use it for all of my open source projects. It's an awesome tool.
Like centralization of Javadoc, for example?
Yeah, it is. It works kind of like Javadoc because comments, the documentation that's in the Python code itself, can be used to annotate the HTML. So it's nice.
Cool.
There's just not like I'm trying to advertise Top Braid, but they've got this thing called Sparkle Web Pages now, which is what they use for just that, also generating web pages basically, or LaTeX or PDF out of an ontology.
Yeah. Well, this is free.
Yeah.
Top Braid is not.
That is true.
All right, so objects in BACnet are composed of properties, and there are three different types of properties. Those that are optional, those that are required to be present and readable using BACnet services, and those that are required to be present, readable, and writable. Okay, so every vendor for their implementation of BACnet for their objects has a whole variety of types of properties that they have to support to be interoperable, and are other ones that are based on the sort of level of integration of BACnet into their product that they want to do. So for me, because I'm not actually a product vendor, I'm a gateway software writer, my presentation of points that are from other protocols into BACnet have a fairly limited number of these optional readable and writable properties. So the support that you get out of a specific vendor will be depends on, you know, their expertise and, you know, how big their R&D department is, and because these BACnet objects can be pretty big. There can be lots and lots of them. If there's going to be a follow-up to this hackathon, then it would be to understand how to model for any one object the collections of properties that are required to work together if an object supports a certain kind of behavior. So, for example, if there's an analog input object that supports change of value reporting, so let's say that this analog input is tied to an airflow sensor, and the airflow, of course, varies continuously, and if you want to know when the airflow has changed by more than 100 CFM, then tell me what the new value is. Okay, that's called COV notification. So you can do COV notifications on things like binary inputs is done all the time, and analog values that have changed by more than a few units, whatever the kinds of units those are. So for the outside air temperature, we might have a change of value increment of 1 degree. For a 20,000 CFM fan system that is supplying, you know, one of our research labs, you know, a COV increment of 1 is ludicrous because it will essentially generate a denial of service attack on the network with COV notifications.
Mm-hmm.
So as we get deeper into the BACnet object modeling, there's different layers of combinations of required readable and required writable properties. But we don't have enough time to be able to get into that now. This is my way. You'll notice up at the top of the property thing, it says I have this as a subclass of an OWL functional property. I'm not convinced I can necessarily do that. Is that appropriate?
You can't do it.
Not the way you're doing it.
Not in DL, no.
Because you're making something a class and a property, which you can't do in DL.
Okay. So how do I describe what kind of thing this is without describing that it is a subclass of a property?
Well, you could have a subproperty of, first of all.
Oh, there is a subproperty of?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that.
There is, although I'm not sure that's... I think my temptation would actually be to use annotation classes for the required versus optional versus... I don't remember. I'm looking at a different page. Sorry.
Okay. I'm not sure how that would look. Because all the annotation classes that I've seen are all things like comment and author and, you know, provenance information.
Well, you can define your own annotation properties. What it just means is that they actually aren't part of the logical machinery.
Okay.
So I mean, you know, preferred color, icon, you know, anything like that.
Okay.
But there is a property of relation that you could use.
Okay. So, for example, as you scroll down to the object, then there is one object class that has four. Wait a minute. Three? No. Yes, four. Yeah, it has four required properties. So the object identifier property, which refers to an instance of an object identifier. Recall that that's considered a primitive data type in BACnet. The object name, which is a string that must be of length 1. And the object type, which refers to one of those enumerations, which either can be a standard type or a vendor extended type. And it has a property list, which is a list, not an array, but a list of property identifiers that are appropriate for that specific object. So each object is sort of self-describing by saying that by having the property list describe which properties are available out of that implementation of that object in that device that you can query over the network.
Is the order of those properties significant?
No.
You've already got one problem, which is that your domains and ranges, if you're going to use domains and ranges, are in conflict with the super property. So, you're going to have a problem there. If you use the restriction classes, you won't run into that problem.
Okay.
Although.
Yeah, the restriction also has a nice way of kind of grouping all of these things together as well.
Because if you think of, subclass is really a subset, so you can't have different domains and ranges in the subset as in the superset.
Yeah, I think.
Well, if there's a set of things that have certain behavior, and if you're pulling a subset of that thing, it can't have different behavior. It can have a specialization of the behavior, but it can't have a different one. So unless you're very careful about your domains and ranges, which are all proper subsets of the super property, you'll run into a contradiction.
Okay. I think at some point we'll have to focus on a specific instance of that. I mean, I tried to make sure that there was a distinction between object properties and data type properties in the definitions of these things. Of, like owl name, for example, is a data type property because I know that eventually it points to a string, while I know that an object identifier points to another object.
Right, but the superclass says, or the superproperty, it says the range is property identifier, right?
Right.
And is that a superclass of object identifier?
No, it is an object identifier.
Right, so it's going to be a problem because your object identifier, let's see, I'm going to get these terms straight here. Your object class, you're saying, is a subclass of readable property, which is a subclass of property. And yet the range is at least some possibilities are just not disjoint, but different, or not in the subclass property identifier.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I haven't specified range for the object identifier of a specific object because I didn't want that. I wanted to wait until I defined the range down to where I was defining a specific property, object name or object type.
You have just specified the range as object identifier.
Yeah, for that particular property, for the object identifier property.
Right, which is a subproperty of property, right?
Right.
So
I think actually you probably don't want to use subproperties here. I mean, sometimes it's useful to kind of, you think you can kind of do that for categorization of properties, but, what it actually ends up inferring is a bunch of statements like, you know, this object property ID, you know, value, which is pretty meaningless.
So here's an example of something. Let's see. Outside air temp. Okay. So that's an OAT in the front of that in the chat room. You know what I wanted to be able to say is that I have a thing called OAT, right, which is a named individual that has an object name property that is this thing in quotes, right? So that object name property itself has properties, right? I mean, it has a domain and a range, and it has an enumeration value that appears out of one of the property identifiers, so that I know if it's a BACnet property or a vendor property.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, you know, it seems like subproperty of would work.
Well, what subproperty of really means at the O level is essentially that you can infer a different predicate from a given one. So the classic example is something like father of XY implies parent of XY. And if you have sort of a kind of a vacuous characterization, you know, as a top-level property, you end up with, you know, AT property, you know, outside air temp without knowing what specific property it is. So from an inference standpoint, I don't think this case makes sense. The distinguishing parents versus fathers and mothers, you know, is does make sense for many applications. You want the power basically to query at either level.
Right. But in this case, this is sort of like, in Python they call it decorating. You know, I want to be able to take a class and I want to be able to decorate it with other kinds of attributes.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can query not just the data model portion, but you can query the descriptive layer of the model.
So annotation properties are probably the closest equivalent to the decorations you see there.
Okay.
I mean, your properties can have all kinds of other properties of their own, right? They're first class objects, so you can do what you like with them. And the whole domain and range mess, you can stay away from if you're using the restriction classes. They can be, you know, intersecting or disjoint or overlapping or whatever. You don't have to get into that mess.
Okay. All right. So I sort of have two questions. One is the object type property of an object has to be the same as the object type portion of its object identifier. Remember that the object identifier has two pieces, a type and an instance number? Well, the object type is exposed at the object layer as a separate object type reference. Okay, so let me type something into the chat room here.
Yeah, lost.
OAT has an let me make sure I get the syntax right here. Object. Object.
You want to specify a rule that describes the relationship between values of different properties.
Analog input object.
I got to step away 5 minutes. I'll be right back.
Okay. Object and has an object identifier.
Did someone join us on the call just now?
Yeah, Derek LaSalle's here.
Hi, Derek. Are you part of Joel's team?
It's been in the invite for this, so I'm not sure whose team I'm on.
Hey, you are now.
The next one.
Okay.
So welcome.
All right. All right. So,
we,
uh,
we,
I'm still trying to find my way around here. Chat room 2, you say?
No. Chat room ends in HT-01. What are you looking at? Are you on a web page of some sort, wiki page of some sort?
Yes, I am.
What is the page title?
Page title is, Summit Hackathon.
All right. Here on the Summit Hackathon page, the first bullet point says Hackathon Clinic event schedule.
I'm looking at what looks like to be a series of conversations with Peter Yim here. I'm on the main page.
Right. Oh, you on the main chat page. Okay. So scroll all the way to the bottom.
Okay. Should I be in the 8-3 or the meeting?
You need both. No, scroll all the way to the bottom of that chat. You want two tabs open, one for each. The link that ends in HC01, that's where we are doing the chat, and the other link that says BACOUL, back call, that is the document that's being reviewed, so you want both.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay,
Joel, looks like you have not changed your settings to hide smileys yet.
Oh, let's see. You're right. Let's see. Settings. I thought hiding smileys was on the client side, not on the transmission side.
It's on the client side? Yeah, it's on the client side. And then I don't see it as a smiley. You did.
Okay. Okay.
So if you also check the member settings, then the next time you're in this, you won't see smileys anymore.
I'll just try this again, and I'm going to make a very minor modification to this because this is actually OID type. Okay. All right. So on the line that I just typed in is the definition of an object, which is an analog input object. Okay. So it has an object type property that references the analog input object enumeration. Okay. And it also has an object identifier, which means analog input 15. Okay, so it's the object identifier type property needs to refer to the same thing that the object type property refers to of the object. You see those two occurrences of analog input object? Mike, do you see that?
I was just thinking. I mean, my inclination was the same as Evan's, to basically define the relationship using rule, although I was trying to figure out, I think in this case. So does an object always have an identifier?
Yes.
Okay. So one option would be basically using a property chain.
Okay.
So basically you chain together object type and object identifier and OID type.
Okay.
Object type.
Now I don't know how to, do that in OWL. I've seen examples of people doing that in Squirrel. I think.
Squirrel is easier and more general, but you can also add property chains let me see if I can. I really have to think about a little bit when I write them.
No, that's fine. I'll look it up. Okay. Property chains.
So you define object type as a property chain based on the object identifier and the OID type.
Okay. All right. I sort of have two other kind of higher layer questions. One is every BACnet physical device out in the field has a special object in it called a device object that has a bunch of properties that describe the physical box itself. And it can only have one instance of a device object in a BACnet device. So is there some special kind of restriction that I can specify once I have a thing called a device?
Well,
I don't have one called device in my ontology right now, but I'm going to have one.
Okay, I'm back.
So each device is unique?
Every device that is out in the world is a little physical box. You know, it's got a MAC address and it's got some other kind of stuff in it. And when you talk to this thing, it has one and only one device object. Okay, which is an instance of a thing called, a device object type.
Right. So that sounds like just a cardinality restriction.
Okay. And
you can think of functional property as being a global cardinality restriction to be 0 or 1.
Right, that's
people
right.
People often forget the 0 part.
Okay. So can I also do property chains to make sure that every object defined in a device has a unique object name?
I think what you want... Every object is unique. Simple answers now.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Evan.
Property chains are really limited in L2.
Uh-huh.
You can only build them between things that have a logical super type of that property.
Okay, so you can't do regular part of or container kinds of... I'm not sure exactly how I can describe a BACnet device as being a collection of objects, one of which is a device object, and all of the objects in the collection have unique names. I mean, that's sort of my target goal.
Well, you can define inverse functional properties or keys, you know, for the device, for instance.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think you're going to have to essentially, assuming it's correct, that you need to do it at the class. Is it global uniqueness or is it uniqueness only within the collection?
Within a device, objects within a device have to be unique. The device name, which is the object name of the device object, has to be globally unique on the network.
Okay. So it sounds like the key is basically, for the components, is the device ID and the component ID.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Device ID becomes like a namespace?
No, it's actually another property. So the has key basically allows you to have multiple properties to uniquely identify an object as opposed to just one. So you can think of it as having, you know, multi, in a database world, of having a primary key with multiple columns.
Okay. The last thing down at the bottom is how do I make sure that the object type property out of a proprietary object references an enumeration value that's defined out of the vendor's namespace for that object. So if I'm happy face engineering and I have a happy face object and I've defined my own object type for that, then I want to make sure that the vendor identifier that is in the device object matches the vendor identifier or the vendor association for the object type enumeration, so that all those are bound to the same concept. Mm-hmm. Right, so down at the bottom, I have this thing called vendor, which is a relationship between a proprietary object and some vendor. There's a specific way of being able to build that relationship that, you know, I'd be happy to write in Prolog, but I don't know how to do it now.
So, particularly, one of the things is the L restrictions and really all the L conscious constructs essentially give you inferences rather than constraints.
Okay.
So this may be a better example of actually expecting to use the ontology with a rule system you know, like Swirl or Gemma has a built-in rule engine or others. And in those cases, you can actually define rules that basically really do implement integrity constraints. So, you know, if it's used one of these where they don't match, it basically, you know, creates an exception object or possibly takes some action or something like that. You might be able to at least express the relationship there with a, again, using property chaining. I didn't internalize it quite enough.
Yeah, basically, you're saying the associated vendor specifies then the enumeration that you can use.
Right. Because you know, vendor A cannot use property defined by vendor B.
Help me clear the sound on my end.
Is
the only one that's echoing crazily.
Okay,
right. I think it's you, Joel.
All right, just hang on. I'll be right back.
All right.
I thought it was me.
It wasn't you. Derek, just to make sure you're in the right part, three different hackathon projects going on. So this is the BACnet project. Are you in the right room?
I have no idea. I really don't. I've got one going on GoToMeeting. I'm not even sure. I have to admit, I didn't do my homework to actually determine what was going on here. Sort of a last minute being able to attend. So you have to give me a minute to get my bearings here.
Give us a little context. Why are you here? Who prompted you to... to join us?
Mike Bennett was looking for a volunteer.
Then you want to be at the GoToMeeting session. That's the session he is running.
Okay.
Instead of HC-01, you should check into HC-03.
03.
That's his check. Project. Yeah, 03.
Roger
I
that.
I think they were taking a break just a moment ago. They may be back now.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, sorry. I should have asked earlier.
Yeah, well, no worries.
When I was asking whether you're Joel's team, you should have just said no.
Well, I wasn't sure what I was being volunteered for. It's, you know,
typical thing
in the Army. You'd never support and volunteer for anything. Here I am. Question, this particular group, what is the focus of the work here? Because what you're doing actually is quite interesting to me. So,
there is a communications protocol called BACnet, which is defined by the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers. That is for communications between building automation and control systems.
Okay, so Johnson Controls Life Facilities using X10, is this?
No.
X10 is another version of the same functional concept.
It's competition.
Right, but it is definitely competition. Yep.
Okay, so how does this interrelate? I also did some work on the smart grid protocols. How does this interrelate to that work?
You can think of the smart grid as between facilities and sort of the power grid and utility companies and the distribution systems. And BACnet would be used within a facility or within a campus.
But also we're defining in the smart grid, metering and measurement all the way from the devices within a home, collecting that information,
right.
Power usage, utilization, also pricing,
yep.
And push all the way up into the trading environment.
I can jump in there. If you're familiar with the PAP concept in the smart grid, it relates to PAP 17, sort of, because that's the facility smart grid information model, and we're talking here about one of the things BACnet wants to do is integrate with the facility.
Ah, okay, so there is a point of integration with the PAP.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep,
Steve and I are on the same team.
Right.
Within
I am also.
Oh, yeah, Evan. Yeah, sorry.
Evan is too.
Yeah, I did. I was at the initial kickoff of that back in Chantilly when I was at J.P. Morgan, representing financial services industry and fixed messaging, making sure that we could interleave in the price signaling into the trading environment for energy trading.
That would be the EMIX standard. Yeah.
Exactly. That would be the EMIX. Exactly. So, but since I left J.P., I haven't really been up to speed. So this will have some.
Yeah, it's designed, we want to make sure. I mean, this is a messaging standard which will support an information standard like the FSGIM.
But the messaging standard, is it a proprietary protocol, or will it be leveraging some of the existing standard protocols for messaging?
This is a standard protocol.
Yeah, I mean, BACnet is, standards 135. Which is a European standard and international standard.
Okay. Interleaving or integration with any web-based W3C standards, by any chance?
I would like to be able to make sure that this can merge up with some of the ontology definitions for sensor networks. It's probably about the closest that the W3C. I mean, there's nothing like SOAP
and WS addressing and reliable messaging and any of those standards.
Yeah, there's part of the BACnet standard has its own SOAP model. It's called BACnet Web Services, and
okay.
It has its own chapter within the BACnet standard.
Oh, okay. So I need to go take a look at that. Well, good. Well, forgive me. Thank you very much for bringing me up to speed as to what you gentlemen are doing. It's very interesting, and I'll leave you to your good work.
All right.
Okay. Cheers.
Have fun with Mike.
Bye.
So is my voice better now?
It's better.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the only last thing I wanted to cover before letting you go off to your normal lives is the engineering units. And how to go about mapping BACnet definitions of an engineering unit into some other standard. So there is an engineering units enumeration in BACnet that is just a flat list of labels and numbers. There's no organization. I mean, there's a little bit of, these are energy and these are temperature and, these are area and this is currency. And, there's a little bit of organizational structure if you read the standard in the comments. But other than that, it's just a flat list of label versus enumeration values. For example, degrees Fahrenheit is number 64 that I've pasted into the chat room. So my question is, how would I go about saying that BACnet's version of degrees Fahrenheit matches up with the same conceptual degrees Fahrenheit that I would get from one of the NIST units models?
Hmm. Almost there, but not quite there. ISO 80000 is the one, right? It's the standard for units of measure. The right way to do it would be to reference a standard ontology for units of measure.
Right. But we don't have one yet?
We don't have one yet. There's work in progress in various places, including there's an OASIS committee And there's you can visit QUDT.org as a good candidate for units of measure ontology.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, would you... I mean, the OASIS work hasn't reached light of day, right? It's still
correct.
Stuck in committee. And boy, am I pissed at Cornell. not to voice how angry I am, but I am really angry at Cornell. So the lawyers wouldn't let me attend. So
check out.
We had a similar problem.
Yeah, we did at NIST.
They should be more angry at NIST.
But Joel, for actual content, you might want to check out QUDT.org because they've got a pretty comprehensive treatment right now of an ontology for this.
Okay.
But it's not a standard.
Okay.
And it hopes to be.
Okay. But as long as I can show, I mean, the end result of this work is to understand how to take this and apply it to a broader domain. And in order to fit into the domain of, you know, W3C sensor networks or, you know, the facility smart grid or any of these other things, you know, I wanted to start out with something concrete, and then gradually work my way into integrating with other standards.
Yeah.
So is this so can I pick something out of here that's an owl same as and, be happy, happy?
You could. Like you need a degree Fahrenheit thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that.
Well, it depends. I don't remember how the model does units.
Which model?
The QUDT.
Ah, well, let me go quick check.
I mean, it depends. I mean, it's probably as in a quantity value, right? Sort of the SI way of thinking of it.
Quantity type, yeah. Temperature, you
know. No, the quantity type would be temperature.
Right. A quantity kind, rather, would be... let's see. Let's get their terminology right. Yeah, I think. Give me a minute, and I'll go look it up. And I bet you I can find you a URI.
Okay, that would be outstanding because I can't weed my way through that enough to recognize what the distinctions are. I mean, you know, while we were working on the on our stuff before it moved over to OASIS, I sort of had my brain wrapped around it. But then you left, and I couldn't follow. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to resume that work, hopefully, after this summit.
So, in a sense, would this be, we're just thinking of this thing as being another nation for what the other ontology would call Fahrenheit?
I don't
think about conceptually what same as would mean because that's where the danger is, right?
Right. In other words, I want when you get something out of BACnet that says it's of type engineering unit 64, I want to present that to the outside world as meaning degrees Fahrenheit. Same as is probably the wrong relationship, but there's there might be some annotation property I could make up that would mean that.
Well, I think what we do, we actually need something that's a bit weaker than same as for these kinds of purposes.
You could actually use things like some of the Scoss relationships, for example.
Oh.
Looser.
Right, that's true.
So a kind of like related term. Or things like that. So when you were referring to the same as, I assume you were thinking, my suggestion rather than, might be to use QEDT, rather than just kind of equating terms that you have to it. But if there are differences, then you want some to be able to capture that as well.
Right. I mean, I'm convinced that BACnet has units that don't exist in QEDT.
Okay.
I also need to be able to decorate, if you will, those units with BACnet's, nominal value.
Okay, well, you can certainly, you're free to say, make statements about QEDT classes, so the decoration isn't an issue there.
Okay.
But, the mantra is that anybody can say anything about anything. The semantic differences are more of an issue. The same as essentially means that you can actually substitute statements about one for statements about the other. That's probably stronger than you want.
Okay. All right, well, that covers my agenda for what I could comfortably comprehend for this hackathon. So thank you.
Well, Joe, I think I commend you on the job that you've done. I know it's been a lot of work and
outstanding.
Yeah.
And a wonderful session.
And depressing as to how much work it is.
Well, I'm halfway through the standard, so the next round is going to be objects and properties, and then the next round after that will be web services, because it really is a different data model.
The results of this are more useful than just for BACnet. I mean, there's two kinds of good things that you get out of it. One, this whole issue of how to deal with ASN1, and then two, probably patterns that could be reused for other standards like this.
Well, I hope you should participate in the ongoing work, which we label as standards-based ontology. We sort of paused that for the ontology summit, but we should be resuming that and be active on that.
Please. Yep, that mailing list has been pretty quiet.
How many years ago was that?
No, it was just before the ontology summit. The ontology summit was 2009, but then we resumed that work. You remember?
Lost your sound, Peter.
And 100 people. October, just late last year, and we said we will pause for the ontology summit, but we'll resume after that.
Okay.
So a whole bunch of.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you.
Wonderful work, Joe.
Yeah, I know. It's been a lot of fun. I've really appreciated it. So.
Right. You will get prepared to present at the Ontology Summit Symposium.
Yep, I got to make travel plans and do all that kind of stuff. So
you're going to make it this time?
Yeah, I'm desperately trying to figure out how to make it.
Are you registered?
No, not yet.
Yeah, register. Closes on the 22nd.
Even if you don't come.
Just
make sure you get on our list to get on campus.
Okay.
That's true.
Hey, great.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. Take care.
Okay, bye.
And I'll,
thanks, guys.
I'll see if I can email you a URI for Fahrenheit.
Okay. All right. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.